Hello and welcome to the Practical Tech Leadership Podcast from Venturi's Voice. I'm your host, Andy Davis. In this show, I'll be chatting to C-level executives from all sectors about their careers in tech. The show aims to bring you insights, anecdotes and stories from like-minded professionals that you can learn from and apply to your own career. If you like the show and want to hear more from us, you can follow us via SoundCloud, iTunes or Spotify, or join us on Slack. Thank you and enjoy the show. Also, we've got Mark Zhao Saunders here. He is the CEO and founder at Filtered.com. Mark, thank you so much for taking the time, mate.
Hi, Andy. Nice to be here.
Yeah, very much looking forward to having you on the show. I was really excited about this one, actually, for a while after Josh mentioned that you were going to make an appearance on the show. It took us a while to get there, but like they say, great things are worth waiting for. Is that the saying?
It's something like that. I think it's not exactly that, but I know what you mean.
Yeah, I've never been one for philosophical quotes, but yeah, great to have you on the show, mate. There's loads that I want to kind of get stuck into and ask about, but before I do, would you mind giving the listeners a bit of a brief overview of your sort of background and experiences?
Me, myself? Yeah. Sure. Well, I mean, my career started a long time ago, 18 years ago, at a strategy consultancy, a place called Mars & Co. in Victoria. Ever since then, I've been doing, and I was there for a couple of years, picking up business skills, working extremely hard for clients, trying to work out what drives success for clients. But it was always with a view to be doing my own thing. So to, you know, establish a skill set that would be useful in two companies, including my own, and then run them, start them up. So then I was involved in a couple of startups, one of which Pure Potential still goes, which helps bright estate educated students with their next steps in life, be it apprenticeships or school or a university. And then started this business, Filtered Technologies, in a decade ago, 2009. It was just a hobby for a while, but then it gained traction. There was revenue, there was staff, it became serious, and now it's pretty serious.
Awesome, mate. So you kind of always had that intuition to make things happen, be a bit of an entrepreneur. I don't think it's a too dissimilar story for people who've been in like strategic consultancy or whatever. Like, you seem to find that there's quite a common kind of, I don't know, like step before entrepreneurship. What do you think that you took from that experience that you think, you know, kind of enabled you? Is it just the exposure to a lot of different experiences? What is it that it seems to be relatively common?
I think you're right. There are a lot of people that go from strategy into running their own business. I think there are a lot of people that don't as well. And it's generally a very good grounding for a business career, whether you're doing your own thing or part of a bigger thing that someone else has set up. In terms of what I took from it to go down the path that I chose, something very specific and then lots of things that are very general. So the general stuff is general business skills. It's kind of professionalism, it's analysis, it's interacting positively with clients, building relationships, all of those soft skills and some hard skills that you need to be useful in business. So that's and it gives you a very sort of even distribution of skills if you're working in strategy, because by definition strategy is generic and important. The specific thing that it gave me was working in a strategy consultancy, which is particularly numerate. They actually asked for the consultancy I was at. They specified that you had to have done a hard science degree at uni in order to work there. So it was really numerate. So that meant a lot of spreadsheeting, a lot of Microsoft Excel in particular. And I didn't have any of those. I didn't have those skills at all when I went into that place of work. But I developed them, after 9 months, I could use Excel in a useful way. And that gave me the insight that this program, this application is so useful, but also that most people can't use it very well. also that you don't actually need to know that much in Excel in order to be very useful. You just need 20, 25 functions and features and some experience of how to apply them, and you can really go quite far. It's something, it's the 80-20 rule.
Mm.
And that really was the kernel for the business that I run now, Filtered, which is that if you can put in front of people the most relevant piece of learning for them, for their role, for their aspirations, you can make a tremendous difference to their personal productivity, to the productivity of that firm, to their clients. And also, crucially, and this is something that's fortunately become more important in the workplace over the last few years, to how people feel at work, that they are really making a tangible difference, that their work is valued, that they have purpose. I'll just say one more thing on this, Andy. I know I've been talking for a while, but with Excel in particular, I mean, this applies to other disciplines as well, but with Excel, one of the things that it gives you is, you know, that technical ability to, you know, compare databases or manipulate data or whatever. But at a higher level, what it's enabling you to do is to make better decisions. And if you can back the decisions that you're making in business with data through your own unique analysis, that makes you feel much more in control of just what you're doing at work.
Mm.
And that's something I feel strongly about, because, you know, a lot of people go into the workplace, they don't have a lot of knowledge and by definition a lot of experience at the start. They don't feel, they're not enjoying it. They don't feel in control. They don't have that sense of agency. But with the right skills that can be reasonably efficiently and through tech distributed sensibly, you can get people to a higher level of confidence, and that's you know, emotionally and intellectually what lies behind the business.
Interesting, yeah, that's so interesting. It's like, was it like a realization then when you kind of acquired? I'm sure it wasn't like an instant aha moment, but there was that sense and that realization that you went through, so almost seemingly so much so that it then kind of spawned itself into a business idea. I just find that really compelling, to be honest.
Well, the aha. Well, yeah, there kind of was, actually. There was the going through the experience as a new employee and not adding value for, you know, quite some time, and then finally getting to a point where I am adding value and sort of seeing that this could be done more efficiently. That was sort of hard won experience over, you know, a couple of years, you know, many months at least. But it was after I left that consultancy and having dinner with one of the guys, actually, who's now co-founder, Chris Littlewood, of Filtered, over an evening meal. We were just discussing exactly this point, and that was the sort of the aha moment of, well, yeah, what we went through was important. It's given us these skills, but it could have been done much better. And so as much as there was an aha moment, it was that. It was, you know, two co-founders who got together and had that conversation, and soon after that we got Vinit Patel involved. He's the third co-founder. There's three of us, and launched the business. So yeah, I mean, it's nice, those stories that are sort of pure aha. Mm. This is a little bit more sort of convoluted than that, but not much. There was a specific conversation that I still remember now and I'm thankful for, with Chris and the Chinese on Gerrard Street in Soho.
Yeah. I'm sure the spring rolls are phenomenal. The first couple of businesses, it seemed like they were kind of marketplace kind of startups, and essentially brokering, you know, whether it be people with people or technology with people. What do you think you found interesting, compelling, challenging with operating within sort of a, I don't know if it is a, you would identify as a marketplace, but, you know, something similar to a marketplace environment?
So when you say marketplace, you mean matching people with something?
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Well, I think, so I'm not sure this answers your question, but I've got some things to say anyway, broadly on this topic. So because there is now so much stuff out there, and I mean physical items, you know, factories are just all over the world and so efficient. So there's just lots of physical stuff in the world. But then also more obviously, and to a much greater extent, digital products, content, podcasts, films, you know, songs, just everything. There has become a need to broker efficiently, effectively, intelligently in a way that users are going to enjoy. So if you look at a lot of the companies that have become extremely successful in B2C, actually, they're not adding anything to the world in terms of new writing or new songs. They're doing the distribution. They're being that marketplace. So that's what Netflix is. That's what Spotify is. That's what Amazon mostly is. A slightly complicated business. But in terms of their e-commerce store, that's what it is. It's sort of fulfilling orders for stuff. And although in learning, I feel like it's a worthier goal than sort of pure entertainment or e-commerce or even information. And so I don't use the term marketplace to describe it. It is exactly that. It's intelligently matching people with stuff that will benefit them, whether they know it or not, and making that experience enjoyable enough that they will come back the next week and come back after. So there's been more and more of this sort of marketplace type solution because there's been more and more stuff. You know, whereas before, just having anything were, you know, sort of differentiated you, and you know, as a consumer, as an individual, you know, it's hard to get, you know, food to eat or a newspaper to read. Now there's so much choice. You know, people are overwhelmed, overburdened, sick to death of it, and so there is a need for a different kind of service, which is filtering effectively. I mean, that's also why we spent $10,000 on the name filtered.com, because it does exactly what it says on the tin, and that is, you know, there's a clear need amongst people for that kind of a process.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting, isn't it? Really, it's actually really interesting to kind of actually take a step back and think about that from a perspective. But that's been relatively new, hasn't it, really, that these kind of marketplaces have all of a sudden dominated in the way that they are now doing. And it's interesting, isn't it, that the consumer needs, I suppose, are always met. That's the beauty of business, I suppose. But, you know, what's next? You know, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, some of the, well, we started off with data in basically Excel form. The way that kind of the data movement is going towards, you know, the machine learning algorithms, you know, AI, what's going to be kind of next? What's that going to generate as far as a demand from your perspective?
Well, I think if you want a clue as to what's coming next in our field, it makes sense to look at those fields that are sort of adjacent, but have some structural similarities. So, like I said, with entertainment and, you know, using examples like Netflix, Spotify, YouTube, what you've got going on there is algorithmic activity, which gets very well chosen relevant content to users. And you have users, well, many users, almost addicted to that process of having the next song selected for them or the next video played for them. Now, I don't think in learning specifically we're going to have that kind of level of stickiness or engagement, because the nature of learning is that the benefits are felt in over the long term, or mostly felt over the long term, as you apply this better way of project managing or this better way of communicating with your boss. And then that's empowering, and you've got a nice feedback loop, but a loop that lasts over, you know, months and years, rather than just enjoying that video while it's playing and then forgetting about it later. So there are some differences too, but in general, what we're talking about is getting the very best of the content that can be helpful in a learning context, to users in an efficient, enjoyable user experience. And I think this is the move that lots of companies are sort of actually shifting towards. The phrase consumer grade is used frequently in our industry now, because people are aspiring to, or the vendors are aspiring to deliver something which looks a bit like the software that we use in our consumer lives. But that is not just in terms of the interface and how nice it looks on your iPhone or whatever. It's also how it's all the intelligence behind that system that generates that content, which you're really likely to not just click on, but enjoy and come back to. So really, I think what's coming is an experience which is more and more similar to YouTube, who are probably the best at making recommendations on the planet. And YouTube is part of Google, so you know they've got hardware and software behind that. So that you get a more sticky product. Yeah, that's what I would say on to answer your question as to what's coming.
Awesome, right? And you know the direction your business is going as well. With the excitement around sort of going through growth and scaling up now, you must feel kind of relatively well positioned in a sense, or at least certainly excited at the very least about, you know, you're now in a position to actually kind of move with the trends and use that kind of strategic learnings to, in order to ensure that, you know, you are on track, on trend. It must feel like you're kind of well positioned to, considering the position that the business now is in.
Yeah, we definitely feel well positioned. I wouldn't say I feel satisfied. It's kind of my job to not feel satisfied ever. And I mean, as I think you've been told, we recently raised a Series A. So there's 2.5 million quid came into the business. That obviously is welcome. And also is a strong endorsement of the specific thing that we're doing. So whereas there's a lot of money that goes into corporate learning from, you know, venture capitalists and private equity companies, it generally goes into platforms, marketplaces, or content providers. These are safe bets because they've been making money for, some of them have been making money for a long time. What we're doing is genuinely new. It's none of the above. It's making better sense of the above and you know, its recommendations, and bringing that technology to bear on the whole problem, so that people learn better and feel better at work. And to have some serious injection of cash into that niche area is the endorsement, not just of what we're doing, but that is a direction that the market's going to be headed in. I think it is. Are we well positioned? Yeah, I think we've got a good reputation. We've got a great team. I mean, everyone says that, but we really have. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's blood, sweat, and tears to get to that point. We've been around for 10 years. We've been iterating on, you know, how to hire well, how to create a good, transparent, open culture where anyone can offer their opinion. No one's wrong, but where we can be straightforward with each other about disagreements when they do come about. And of course, it's not perfect, but I'm very happy with where we've got to. And we transitioned someone from a different role into a head of people role. So thinking now that we're over 30 staff, that we'll need that, and we need to thinking about the long term, need to pay that more attention. So yeah, I think the stars are aligning better than ever before. The investment is great and good timing. If you look at the roadmaps, actually, of a lot of our potential competitors, learning management systems, learning experience platforms, and what have you, they increasingly include the thing that we're totally focused on. Excuse me. They increasingly include the features that we're totally focused on, which is recommendations, and that is a little bit of a concern, but also, you know, a big endorsement of us going down the path that we've gone down for the last three years.
Absolutely. With all the things, like, this is the layman in me coming out, but with all the recommendations, endorsements, making the platform more sticky, do you almost need to be around for long enough in order to acquire that data? Or is it just to have the technology in the first place that you or the investment in that technology that enables you to do that and do that to the level that, you know, the industry leaders are doing it.
Andy, what do you mean by that data?
So
when you say that data?
So in order to get recommendations, I would assume that, you know, you need to acquire data on what people are actually, what people's activity is, what they're actually purchasing, you know, and then in order to recommend and make the platform more sticky, is that something that you like, you actually just need time in order to accumulate that, or is it a combination of time, good data, and the technology?
Okay. Okay, it's a good question. It's a great question, and it kind of gets to the heart actually of the question of the benefits of and viability of machine learning.
Mm.
So, yes, a machine learning system needs data to have learned from in order to provide a perform at a high level. And at the start, on day one, when you go to a client, where's the data? Mm. So we square that circle by getting a lot of the data offline, and that offline data acquisition comes from understanding the content that a given client has and all the metadata associated with that content and the interrelations between those content assets. So, you know, this podcast from HBR and this video on TED, how close are they in terms of the skills that match with each other? So we build up a skills graph of all of that content, and that is done without, you don't need a single user to have done anything to have that. Then on the user side, we're asking them for explicit information. So we're asking them about their level of seniority, their aspirations, their current knowledge levels. So as part of the product, we get that data. Mm-hmm. So we can do some initial matching, which is meaningful straight out of the box from day one. Then, of course, as the user is learning and bookmarking and making notes and using the platform, basically, the system, we call it Magpie, is learning from what they're doing and making better recommendations. And that's where the machine learning comes in. So what you're describing is called the cold start problem. We've got our way of resolving it. And it's an important question to ask, actually. Anyone that's selling machine learning or AI in some form, like how do you provide a meaningful service on day one? Well, that's how we do it.
Interesting. Awesome, mate. Really interesting stuff. You mentioned, obviously, I suppose with the investment and such, there's also the and the people, the business is going to evolve just by nature, I assume, of sort of bums on seats as well. How can you ever feel prepared for that, to take on an influx of new people? Is that something that you're kind of looking forward to the challenge of? How do you kind of feel about that?
Yeah, I think it's a trap that startups and scale ups can fall into, which is, you know, trying to grow too quickly, dealing with those growing pains, not hiring too fast, and losing some of the culture that was, you know, established right at the start. That's why, like I said, we've appointed a head of people, Catherine, who's just going to be awesome in the role. It's also why you take on some wise heads. So, you know, we've recently appointed a chairman. That was one of the stipulations, actually, of the investment. So, so that we can just, you know, cross the bridges that we are coming up to, which are a little bit unfamiliar, but with a wiser set of heads. We've also got reasonable systems appropriate systems for our size of company to make it clear what people are working on and who has to interact with who. So we use objectives and key results, and we're taking them more seriously than we ever have before. And then also to just be very careful about which recruitment companies where we do want to go to market we use. So another thing that is important is to make sure that the recruitment consultants, if you're going to work with any, are doing just what you need. And that's one of the things I like about Venturi, that you're not just placing candidates in roles, although you're doing that, you're also putting meaningful content out there. This this podcast, for example, to encourage more thoughtful interactions and more thoughtful, people that are looking for jobs, candidates, as well as people that are hiring. I think that is actually it's a big issue for startups. As soon as you raise some money, obviously every recruitment agency within 5 miles is in touch. And I'm in Shoreditch in London, so that's a lot of them.
Yeah.
And actually, I think it was Josh that reached out shortly after our Series A. Because of the nature of how he was reaching out, that was a lot more acceptable than some of the other guys.
Yeah,
you could choose whether to include that or not. But yeah, growing pains. Look, that's just it's a big thing for us. We've got a plan which is to grow, but not grow like ludicrously quickly. So yeah, we've raised all this money, but we have 30 staff. We'll be at 30 something still at the end of this year. We want to grow responsibly and choose the right people. Develop them well, and that means not going, not growing explosively on the HR side, just growing steadily.
Why do you think that is? Because it's a great discipline, great lesson, I have heard that before. I'm sure everyone's heard that before. Like anyone who's been involved in startups and any sort of the nature, it's like, yeah, be careful with, just absolutely growing too quickly or all this. But yet it's something that seems to be so like irresistible. I mean, I've never been a founder of a startup, but like from your perspective, why do you think that it is it's not a trap, but why is it so enticing to just all of a sudden try and double in size? Do you think that there's a little bit of ego attached to something like that?
I was going to give two answers. One of them is actually to do with ego. I think there are a lot of founders and people running businesses that like the idea of employing and being responsible for lots of people. I kind of like that idea, but at the same time, can't think of anything worse as well, where if the business isn't there. So I do think ego is possibly, that's at work somewhere. But I think it's also that the sales pressure, the financial pressure that a lot of startups are on, they take on this money, they've got an aggressive investor, really wants to see certain numbers hit. What levers can you pull? Product is long term, but hiring salespeople is short term. And salespeople are, if they're any good at all, they're good at selling themselves, and that they'll be able to achieve this level of sales quickly. And so you get into this cycle of hiring more salespeople to chase these numbers. But of course, in reality, the ramp up time for salespeople is long, so that's not really going to help in the short term. And then you hire someone, whether they're good or not, they're not hitting those numbers. You feel like you've got to get rid of them, and then you've got high churn. You get a reputation for high churn, and it just becomes a bit of a sad story. So we're really keen to not fall into that trap, which is, like you say, for a couple of reasons and probably some other reasons that I've not mentioned, easy to fall into. But we're aware of it at least.
Yeah, well, I think that's the main thing, isn't it? Yeah, interesting. Mate, so obviously I can't imagine a more kind of exciting place to be, I suppose, at the moment. But if you were to perhaps point out a couple of things that you are particularly excited about over the next sort of, 6 to 12 months or whatever, what is it that, you're particularly compelled by?
I think that there's two aspects to our product. I mean, I'm a more product-oriented person than commercial, of course. CEO, I've got to, have my feet in both camps, but I'm more product-oriented. And the two sort of areas of product development, I mean, really broad areas, this is really a framework for thinking about it, but one is the intelligence. So how good are the recommendations that your technology is bringing to users? How do you judge that? How do you improve it? How much better than the competition can you be? And so there are a number of new playlists that will be introduced that we're going to introduce over the next few months that I think are going to significantly improve the quality of the recommendations, how well they're explained, how well they're received, how much they're used, and of course you get the network effects then of a positive feedback loop and users giving us more data to make better and more data-driven recommendations. So there's just the continual enhancement of the intelligence, including some specific playlists coming out soon. The other thing is placement. So it's all very well saying that you want people to learn and you want them to learn in some way from your system, but where's your system going to appear in the consciousness of a user? They're really busy. Many of them are stressed at work, as things are. They're using 20-odd bits of software at work. So how to make an impact, some sort of how to make an incursion that's useful and thought of as useful by those people. Well, one of the ways is through APIs and having your the benefit of what you're doing of our product Magpie appear on software that they're using anyway. So we actually become invisible, but we are placing what we're doing where users already are. So that might be Microsoft Teams or Slack or even the good old inbox, so through email. And I mean, we're already doing that, but it's sort of how intelligently and effectively you can do that that is going to determine, I think, who wins and by how much in this arena. So yeah, those two broad areas, intelligence and placement, being invisible is another way of putting it, that is sort of most exciting for us and what the investors are excited about and what we've got the money now to drive towards.
Awesome, mate. And finally, before I let you go, mate, just anyone who is interested in careers and stuff, what's the website that they can, is it just filtered careers, is it?
Good question. I think you could always, it's dangerous to email me. It'll be on our website. So yeah, the process will be that's looked after by our head of people, Catherine. So go to filtered.com and you'll be able to find your way to us and applying for a position that you find interesting.
Awesome. Mark, it's been a pleasure, mate. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Andy.
Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturers Voice Slack group. See you next time.